Welcome, welcome to another week of the Little Wireless Program, dear listener. And tonight it's going to be a presentation night. Lots and lots of prizes. For example, I'm about to make a major award to Julian Burnside, and then later you'll meet Inga Saffron, who's an architectural critic for the Philadelphia Inquirer, and she's just won a Pulitzer, and we'll see why. But before we go any further, thank you, John Cleary and Richard Adey, for filling in for me last week when I had a few medical matters to deal with. Now, let me remind you of something, dear listener. The Oak Leaf Cluster is a miniature metal device which is worn by members of the 7 uniformed services of the U.S. On medals and ribbons issued by the Army, Air Force and Department of Defense. I've never awarded an Oak Leaf Cluster in association with the koala stamp, but on this occasion I'm going to give Julian Burnside this rarest of honours, a koala stamp with gum leaf cluster. Julian, congratulations. This is, as I said, it's never been awarded before.
Thank you very much, Philip.
I understand that there's some other award you've just won too. What's that?
Yes, the 2014 Sydney Peace Prize, which I'm very honoured to get.
I can't wait to hear what Alan Jones will have to say about this. I should point out to the listener that I first became aware of Julian's forensic skills when he was the lead inquisitor into the Cash for Comment scandal involving my distinguished colleagues Jones and Laws at 2UE. Alan has still been urging the New South Wales to recruit lots and lots of Roger Ronaldsons right up to the last minute. I'm sure he'll be equally convinced that Julian deserves the Peace Prize. Now, let me say what the jury's citation says. For his brave and principled advocacy for human rights and for those wronged by government, for insisting that we respect our international legal obligations towards those seeking asylum, and for his unflinching defence of the rule of law as a means to achieve a more peaceful and just society. Julian joins me incidentally from our Melbourne studio. Now, it is important for people to understand, Julian, that you don't see the asylum seeker issue, the ongoing crisis, through the prism of party politics, do you?
No, I've never been involved in party politics. I have no interest in party politics. I find it repugnant, to be honest. And in fact, I was a sort of long-time Liberal voter, to be honest. But that's when the Liberal Party could have justified a small L, which is some distance back now.
Well, as you and I have often discussed over the years, the party which I recently resigned from, the ALP, has been complicit in this this national and international tragedy involving refugees. It's been a bipartisan and indeed tripartisan policy, hasn't it?
It has, bipartisan at least. Interestingly, I did a thing at, I think, Ballarat or Bendigo, Ballarat, a few months ago. And there was a person there, this was before the last election, there was a person there, a politician, whose views on asylum seekers were comfortably to the left of Senator Bob Carr. And this was none other than John Madigan. And it was a fascinating thing to see the DLP to the left of the ALP.
Well, I couldn't agree more. Mind you, in April, the Abbott government celebrated 100 days without any asylum seeker boats reaching Australia, Julian. One might observe it's about the only promise the government gave before the election that it's kept. But at what cost?
Well, it's hard to get accurate figures, but I think our struggle against boat people is working out at something like $4 billion a year. It's a lot of money. And the irony is, of course, as you would know, because you probably get overseas more often than I do, our reputation overseas is now shifting from what we used to imagine, that we were friendly, laid-back, easygoing people with a spirit of the fair go, and we're now seen as selfish and cruel. And I don't think that's the reputation that I want this country to have.
You have always argued that we're dealing with a moral issue, an ethical issue. Why don't people understand that?
I don't know. Absolutely right. I do think it's a moral issue from first to last. It's got caught up in politics. But it's unfortunate the way it got caught up in politics, because in 2001, when the Tampa episode happened, John Howard used that specifically for political purposes. But Kim Beazley had a run of bad luck, because just as the Tampa episode was coming to its conclusion, September 11 happened, and all of a sudden it was very difficult for anyone to say anything that might sound as though it was favourable to Muslims or people from overseas or anything else. And Beazley, I think, found himself unable to stand up publicly and contradict the central lie on which the coalition has run this issue, the central lie being these people are illegals and queue jumpers. That's poisoned the debate.
Beazley did, in fact, succumb, surrender, acquiesce, whatever you like to call it, but every subsequent Labour leader or would-be Prime Minister has at least echoed, if not amplified, the Liberal Party line. I mean, Latham was even more virulent. He didn't think that tough policies were anything like tough enough. Neither Gillard nor my friend Mr. Rudd actually covered themselves in glory. They ran 100 miles away from it.
Well, I agree with that broadly, although Rudd in his first time round as PM made some quite good changes in relation to asylum seekers, but that was when they weren't coming. And it's quite easy to be kind and generous to people as long as they don't turn up. I think the difficulty is Beazley was painted into a corner, and the Labour Party, which has never really been all that enthusiastic about foreigners coming here, has actually never contradicted the lie. So they both find themselves, in effect, going along with the idea that boat people are criminals of some sort, which is false. And we now have the absurdity of Morrison renaming the Department of Immigration and Citizenship as the Department of Immigration and Border Protection, as if we need to be protected from asylum seekers. It's really quite bizarre. And the awful irony is that the election last September was the only one in Australia's political history where we've had both major political parties trying to outdo each other in promises of cruelty to a group of human beings. It's absolutely disgraceful, and I hope it never happens again.
I'm talking to Julian Burnside, winner of the Koala stamp with gum leaf cluster, and now the 2014 Sydney Peace Prize. Let's look at some of the specifics. Last week, the first group of asylum seekers to be granted refugee visas were released into the community in Nauru. Now, you've got some deep concerns about this.
Yeah, it's only 11 of them, and the first concern is how long it has taken to process the claims of 11 people. They've been there for a couple of years. It's really slow. Second thing is that the Nauruans, like the Papua New Guineans, are not particularly friendly towards asylum seekers, or indeed anyone coming from outside, and I have concern about how those people are going to cope in their attempt to fit into the Nauruan community. Third, the Australian government says that it will help support them for the first 12 months, but after that, we have no idea what's going to happen to them. Now, Nauru is a tiny country, 21 square kilometres, population of 10,000, no observable GDP. Getting jobs is going to be unbelievably difficult for them. How are they supposed to live? Are they supposed to forage in the street like dogs? I don't know how they're going to survive. And, of course, they have an opportunity, I guess, of going to some other country. Australia has said they can't come here. But how are they going to research another country? How are they going to afford the fare to get to another country? In short, what is going to happen to them after the first 12 months?
Julian, do you think that Australia has an interest in seeing the rule of law fail in Nauru?
Oh, yes. If asylum seekers fail in their first attempt at refugee status, then in theory they have a right to challenge that refusal in the courts. But the rule of law in Nauru has broken down, and the Australian government is supremely unconcerned about that. You may remember that late last year, the only magistrate in Nauru, an Australian, was about to be deported by the Nauruan government. The Chief Justice, the only Supreme Court judge in Nauru, who's also Australian, heard about this and issued an injunction to restrain the government of Nauru from removing the magistrate. But they ignored the injunction and removed him anyway. So the Chief Justice thought he'd better go back into Nauru to try and sort things out. When he tried to get there, the Nauruan government cancelled his visa. So they've kicked out one of their two judicial officers and they've prevented the other one from entering the country. Now, that is the most comprehensive collapse of the rule of law imaginable. And I guess what will happen is that the government of Nauru will install people who are seen by it as a little more agreeable to its views, people who will toe the party line, and that is a failure of the rule of law, about which Australia should be very concerned. You know, we are deliberately sending people across there and throwing their fate into the hands of the Nauruan system, and now we know that we're throwing them into something where they will not get justice.
And we're now talking of throwing them to the tender mercies of Cambodia.
Yes. Well, Australia's form on this issue is to find the most impoverished countries and then wave billions of dollars at them as a bribe so that they will take people off our hands. It's just nothing short of that. And the idea, I understand the CIA were thinking of setting up a detention camp in Cambodia but decided that the conditions were too bad. So here we go, we're going to outdo the CIA.
Julian Burnside on LNL. You believe that it will be even worse for detainees on Manus Island to be released into the community, even worse than into Nauru.
Yeah, the Nauruan natives are not particularly welcoming to people who come from outside. In PNG, things are much worse than that, as we saw in February this year when there was a murderous attack on detainees, with Reza Barati being killed inside the detention centre. Now, it's very hard to believe that the PNG locals will welcome asylum seekers who are given refugee status. And once again, they'll only be given refugee status for a limited time, then they'll have to try and find somewhere else to go.
Scott Morrison released the Manus Island Riots Review today. Had a chance to skim through it?
I have, but only to skim through it. I've only had about an hour to look at it. It's 110 pages long. But one of the interesting things in it is that one of the recommendations is that the eyewitness accounts of the killing should be handed over to the PNG police. Well, there's a flash of insight for you. The police force of the country where the murder happened should be given the eyewitness accounts of the murder itself.
It's interesting, isn't it, that our harsh treatment of boat people, and we're only talking boat people, as you've been pointing out for as long as I've known you, there are many, many other ways to so-called jump the queue into Australia that don't attract this sort of incredible cruelty, this official sadism. But you also make the point that it is inevitable that when people are resettled in what are, of course, by any reasonable definition, concentration camps, it is only a matter of time until they self-harm. That's been the case even before Tampa.
Yes, and there's lots of clinical evidence in Australia that if you lock up innocent people for long enough, they will, after about 12 months, develop fairly serious psychiatric problems, and then after another few months they will either start self-harming or they will lash out at their environment. Both are signs of ultimate despair. Now, we know this perfectly well because we've done it before. It happens in children, it happens in adults, and for some reason we seem to think that it's okay to force them into that. Curiously, in the first time round in the Pacific Solution, it took about 12, 15 months before people began to fall into hopelessness and despair and start harming themselves. This time round, they've been sent there and they've been told specifically, you'll never come to Australia, you may be here for as long as 5 years, it depends on how the no advantage policy affects your case, etc. And it's only taken about 9 months for people to lose hope and to start harming themselves. So Australia has managed to exceed its own rather horrible best.
I lost the thread of my own question before. What I was trying to raise was the issue of deterrence. The argument for cruelty is that it deters asylum seekers, these evil people. But of course, it doesn't effectively deter them. They put themselves at immense risk as CivEx and any number of other mass drownings remind us, because they are leaving situations behind them of intolerable horror.
That's exactly right. The policy of deterrence is one of the ugliest aspects of the recent policy, because when you think about it, deterrence means that you will choose one course in preference to another. Now, the course that we want them not to choose is to come to Australia. They already face the risk of drowning, but now we want to add to the risk of drowning the horrors of being locked up in Manus Island or Nauru, the possibility of being murdered there, the hopelessness that naturally attends those places. And we want them to think that coming to Australia and facing what we can do to them is worse than facing the Taliban or facing the Rajapaksa regime in Sri Lanka. And I wonder how many Australian citizens really relish the idea that Australia will be seen as uglier than the Taliban or nastier than the Rajapaksa regime.
And yet we go on and on with this mantra about tolerance, mateship. You know, this is a part of our mythology, our sustaining mythology about what it is to be Australian. And we manage, of course, to forget the ongoing nastiness of the White Australia policy, which in many ways lives on anew. I am absolutely convinced that a great many Australians do not share the reprehensible views of our shock jocks and our right wing pundits, that they feel very badly about this, very deeply. And I remember a series of columns pre-Tampa that I wrote in the Oz led to $1 million in donations coming in for refugee help from a readership which was allegedly, of course, conservative.
Yeah, look, I agree with all of that. I think the key to it, though, began in 2001 when Howard ventured this idea that these were illegals. And ever since then, with directly calling them illegal and by dog whistle politics, the public have been persuaded that these people are dangerous criminals and that the government is now protecting us from them, and whatever they do to protect us from them is a good thing. Now, I would have to say that if they were dangerous criminals, in fact, I would probably applaud a government that did whatever it needed to do to protect us from them. But when you see through the lie and you see that they're not illegal, they haven't broken any law, they're not dangerous, they're just ordinary frightened people escaping terrors we can scarcely imagine, then it looks very different. Then our behaviour becomes simple, barefaced cruelty.
You're arguing, in a sense, that dog whistle politics is imposing prejudice, bigotry, on our fellow citizens. I don't know whether I agree with you on that. I think there's strong evidence that it's always been simmering away, as, for example, the sudden abrupt rise of our sort of Billy Tea Party with Pauline Hanson. And the thing that we observed is in the aftermath of Hanson, which had her extremely racist policies, was that they became mainstream. They were absorbed to a very large extent by the major parties. And our mutual friend Barry Jones, I remember, made the point that if you wanted 100% of One Nation, you voted for One Nation. If you wanted 80% of it, you voted for the Libs or the Nats. And if you wanted 70% of it, you voted Labour. I mean, during the recent times, Julian, we have, in fact, moved very far and very fast to the right.
Oh, that's true. You know, over the last decade, I've become friends with Malcolm Fraser. And Malcolm and I were on the same platform at a writers' festival, I think in 2003. And I finished my comments with the observation that it was my fervent wish that the next Labour Prime Minister of Australia should be Malcolm Fraser, which got a predictable laugh. And then Malcolm got up to speak and he thanked me for the compliment, but said, of course, it'll never happen. I'm too far to the left for them. And what I don't think Malcolm's political position has really shifted very much since the mid-70s, but what has happened is that the whole political spectrum has moved so far to the right that we now have an extreme right coalition government, a centre-right Labour Party in opposition, and arguably no party of the left, unless you regard the Greens as a party of the left, which is available but not convincing.
I started by mentioning your campaign or your involvement in the investigation into Cash for Comment. How do you feel all these years later when so little seems to have changed in that regard? And at what point in this endless struggle to get justice for asylum seekers do you start to surrender?
Well, you never surrender. That's clear. I thought Cash for Comment ultimately did a bit of good. You know, shining a light into the dark corners does help. And from time to time, we'll go through that again. You know, we're seeing it with the various royal commissions into sexual abuse here and there. And the recent ICAC hearings in Sydney have been a marvellous exercise in light shining. But people are only put off for a little while by that, and then they start falling back into their old habits. I guess you just have to stay vigilant. But as I say to people often, you just don't give up. Because ultimately, in the asylum seeker question, what we're dealing with is what is the character of the country we live in? Are we a country that is gratuitously cruel to innocent human beings, or are we something else? We like to think we're something else, but we're behaving like a country of cruel, ignorant people, which is a tragedy, because I think this is a great country.
Julian, later in the week, Michael Kirby and I are co-launching a book on ASIO files, and I'm wondering if you've read yours.
Well, I've never even asked ASIO for my file. I assume I've got one.
I assume you have, and that it's rather thick.
Well, I guess that could be right. I don't know. I live a very quiet life, Philip, you know.
Well, I raise this because I want to finish up with the issue of ASIO. There are a number of asylum seekers who've been given adverse assessments by ASIO. The reason for such assessments are not disclosed, and there's no legal redress, is there?
No practical legal redress. I've done a couple of cases like this. In one of them, the people who'd been adversely assessed swore on oath that they had never done or said anything that could bring them within the reach of the ASIO provisions. They weren't challenged on that. There was no evidence put forward to contradict that. But ASIO's argument at the end of the case was that the judge could not say that ASIO had made a mistake because it didn't know what ASIO had done. And the judge agreed with that. Now, that raises the horrifying spectre that your life can be blighted by faceless public servants whose reasoning you're not allowed to know and you can't effectively challenge it. Now, that's a terrible thing. You know, that's the world of Kafka.
It is indeed. Now, finally, Julian, you and your wife have begun a campaign to get people to write letters to asylum seekers held on Nauru and Manus. How important is receiving letters for asylum seekers?
Oh, for asylum seekers it's very important because for them it's a sign that they aren't wholly abandoned. by all of Australia. It's a sign that some people know that they're there, some people care about them, and the thought that you haven't been entirely abandoned is quite a valuable thing. And certainly in the early 2000s we had a similar letter writing campaign and received lots and lots of feedback from asylum seekers of how grateful they were that someone had reached out to them.
Well, I'm grateful for your for giving us your time tonight, and congratulations on the Sydney Peace Prize. I know I speak for Alan Jones when I rejoice in this, and congratulations on your koala stamp with Gumleaf Cluster. Barrister, refugee advocate, writer Julian Burnside, and I should point out that he's going to give some of his prize money to a fund to help composers. Explain why.
Well, I'm very keen on music, amongst other art forms, and being a composer is a pretty tough gig. It's probably not as hard as being a poet, but it's a hard way to earn a living, and I've got a few projects going to try and make life a little bit easier for composers in Australia.
Julian, good on you. That's Julian Burnside on LNL, and we go from the Sydney Peace Prize to a fresh recipient of the Pulitzer. LNL on RN, coming up, Inga Saffron.